I thought I would read something from Srimad Bhagavatam for a change. Because the Bhagavatam has everything. So whether you read from here or there, there's always so much within Srimad Bhagavatam. I'd like to discuss a series of verses. Related to Swayambhuva Manu, texts 27 through 34, so that's 8 verses. And it's in relation to the life of Swayambhuva Manu and how he did his worldly duty while maintaining his Krishna consciousness. So I thought there'd be some relevance. You have some worldly duties and you have to maintain your Krishna consciousness. And his worldly duty was more pressing than anything we have to do. But the principles that he applied are very special. They can apply to us also. Can you close the door? Okay, so the second part, why I think this section is nice, is what does Manu do? How does he live his life? So the position of Manu is one of the avatars, those who descend from the spiritual world or who are empowered by the personality of Godhead to perform some direct function on his behalf in this created realm, descends from the spiritual world to this material realm with some particular function on behalf of the Supreme Lord. So they act like the Supreme Lord. How do they live? What are their activities like? Besides their give laws for mankind, what else? Where do they do the rest of their time? So there's a little description of Swayambhuva Manu's residence and his daily life. So the section comes just after the marriage of his daughter, or one of his three daughters, Devahuti, has been arranged with Kardava Muni. Swayambhuva Manu went deep into the forest with his wife and his daughter to introduce his daughter in marriage to Kardava Muni. The exchange between the two, very beautiful section, one appreciating the other in an appropriate manner. Kardava Muni being requested by Swayambhuva Manu to accept Devahuti as his wife, and he gives his reasons why that should be. And Kardava Muni accepts, gives his reasons why he accepts. Gifts had been brought, very luxurious gifts, regal style gifts. And what does a renunciate who's living an ascetic life in the forest need of opulences? But it's not. The dowry in the modern sense of how people calculate those things. It's an appropriate gesture. And after
the exchanges, and Swayambhuva Mallu now realizes on the one hand he's fulfilled his duty as a father, that his daughter is now entrusted to a husband. So his duty is fulfilled. On the other hand, he has very deep affection for his daughter, so he's feeling separation from his daughter. And there's exchanges between the two and expressions of his deep affection for her. And he's about to depart. I'll just read the last two verses preceding this section. Thus relieved of his responsibility by handing over his daughter to a suitable man, Swayambhuva Mallu, his mind agitated by feelings of separation, embraced his affectionate daughter with both his arms. The emperor was unable to bear the separation of his daughter. Therefore, tears poured from his eyes again and again, drenching his daughter's head as he cried, "My dear mother, my dear daughter." And Prabhupada's comment is, a father sometimes addresses his daughter in affection as mother, and sometimes as my darling. Anyway, the feelings of separation are natural. But now his duties are completed, and then now he's departing. So that's where we're beginning, starting with text 27. After asking and obtaining the great sage's permission to leave, the monarch mounted his chariot with his wife and started for his capital, followed by his retinue. So when he came, like Prabhupada says, the king is coming, the king is coming. It means his whole entourage. He's never like walking through the forest alone. He's coming with his whole entourage. Along the way, he saw the prosperity of the tranquil seer's beautiful hermitages on both the charming banks of the Saraswati, the river so agreeable to saintly persons. So, in the purport, Prabhupada explains take prasadam and then go. Okay. Can't have a hungry student sitting in the classroom. Okay, so this is in the very early stages of Satya Yuga. Still, nonetheless, there are, it's not just Kardama Muni off on his own. The indication is there were areas suitable, particularly suitable for rishis, and they associated together. And so along the bank of the Saraswati were residences. Prabhupada writes neighborhood, the rishi neighborhood, where there were apparently a number of rishis and saintly persons living in nice cottages on the banks of those rivers, of the Saraswati River. So he was appreciating how pleasant it is, because he's going to go back to regal life, where it's opulence and complexity and all of that. So in the residences of the Kardamuni and others like him, very, very simple, very peaceful. Just like when we were in Vrindavan, there are a number of places that we went that were very peaceful, unspoiled, non-commercial, like that, real, very, very nice. And Govinda was riding in the car, and he said, this is so different than Vrindavan, where, you know, meaning where once when the Krishna Balaram temple was purchased, in all directions it was just agricultural fields. It was very quiet, simple. In fact, the devotees remarked to Prabhupada, "Do you think it's too far? Because it's, it was, you know, all the action is over there and we're way over here." And Prabhupada said, "No, it'll become like this in time." I mean, now you walk, it's chaos. It started with, you walk out the front gate and all you see is agriculture fields across the way, down to the right, and, you know, it was really simple. And now it's the opposite. So there are some unspoiled places where just walking around, you have the sense of people are living like people lived thousands of years ago, except now there's more tractors. But, you know, like just 15 years ago when we first went, it was bullock carts. Now it's tractors. But like the very first day when we went to Ravel, it was after the harvesting season, because there was one devotee that was with us that said, "I was here 2 weeks ago," and, you know, the 15, 20 ladies are there with the wheat that, you know, there's a stone in the middle, and they boom, 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 boom. They're singing songs about Krishna and thrashing the wheat, getting the wheat kernel separated from the chaff. And it's a whole, you know, by hand, whole production. It's just, and then they bundle it up, and the straw goes here, and the grain goes there, and, you know, singing songs of Krishna. It's just so nice. It's very, very quiet, removed, no blaring. So, like that, Swami Vivekananda was appreciating how tranquil it is, and serene, and conducive for spiritual contemplation. Next, text 28. Overjoyed to know of his arrival, his subjects came forth from Brahmarvarta to greet their returning Lord with songs, prayers, and musical instruments. Prabhupada comments that in the royal era, the kings of Delhi and other places, Hastinapur, there were big walls with certain allowed entrance gates that in the evening would be closed. We could see that when we went to Karoli or in Jaipur, both. There are very few quite narrow entrances, and that allows one into the city or the palace of the king, the area that the king is ruling. And at night, these huge doors are closed. No one can come and no one can go, and there's protection. There are big, tall walls. There's a nice description when we visited the Madan Mohan Temple. The deities of Vrindavan were taken from Vrindavan to Jaipur by Jai Singh. He very humbly called the city of Jaipur after himself, Jaipur, because he was a Rajput king and he wasn't going to have any, you know, Vaishnavas, because traditionally they in Jaipur and in Karoli there were Vaishnavas. So he brought the deities there for protection. They're put in a safe place in different parts of the city. And particularly Madan Mohan, at least, I don't know what happened with Radha Gopinath, but Madan Mohan and Govindaji were right within the palace area. from the very beginning. And some generations passed, and the prince of the king of Karoli was of marriageable age, so the king of Karoli made a marriage proposal, something very similar to this. He went, the king of Karoli, Prabhupada describes this, what happened with Swami Gopamanu is first class. And the first class way, it doesn't always have to happen this way, but the first class way is the father of the father of the son, so the king of Karoli, sent a messenger to the king of Jaipur. My son is of marriageable age, your daughter is of marriageable age. Would you consider a marriage between the two? So, receiving that messenger, he said, well, I think this is a very wonderful idea. I have to consult with my daughter. So the king of Jaipur consulted with his daughter, who said, I would be very happy to accept this marriage proposal on one condition. And the one condition is, I'm very attached to Madan Mohan. So if I marry, I'd like to take Madan Mohan with me from Jaipur to Karoli. So the king of Jaipur said, then forget it, the marriage is off. No marriage. That night, the king of Jaipur had a dream in which Madan Mohan appeared in his dream and said, I want to go to Karoli. I want to be worshipped in Karoli. Please make the arrangement. Didn't say anything about marriage. He said, I want to go to Karoli. I want to be worshipped in Karoli. So when the king woke up, he was torn between ecstasy and sadness because he was also attached to Madan Mohan. But if the desire of Madan Mohan to go to Karoli, so be it. So he made a grand elephant procession from Jaipur to Karoli to take Madan Mohan for worship in Karoli after his daughter was married in Jaipur. So with the daughter came the deity, and since that time the deity has been worshipped in Jaipur, or Karoli. They built a special temple. And the previous arrangement with the family was they were Vaishnavas, and one of the kings in the Jaipur dynasty named Gopal Singh, he conquered some king somewhere, and part of the booty or bounty from the victory was the deity, the Radhakrishna deities. Beautiful Radhakrishna deities were then brought back to Karoli, and they were worshipped as very humbly Radha Gopal. So when Radha Madan Mohan came, what to do? Because they already had a family deity. So what they did was they built a new temple where the understanding was Madan Mohan is the guest, and because he's the guest, he gets served first. But the offerings are made in the kitchen on the side, and they're taken past, but not yet offered to Radha Gopal, and then placed before Madan Mohan and offered to him. And after the offering from Madan Mohan is completed, then they make an offering to Radha Gopal. And they do that like as their regular routine. So that same king who was the son who married the princess later on from Jaipur, later on after the temple was built, there was an invasion. Specifically it says Marwari king. So big army coming to have battle with the king of Karoli. So he got his military going, and the invading army was very, very strong. He closed the gates. The reference, you know, because they're huge, big, thick gates. And the army was, you know, trying to break through the gates and climb over the wall, and he was in great distress. So he went before Madan Mohan and prayed to Madan Mohan. for protection and what to do, it is said, suddenly, without anybody even loading the cannons fired. And with such volleys that happened one after the next, the invading army retreated, and he was protected. And it happened just after his prayer to Madan Mohan. So Madan Mohan protected them. He's a very kind and very famous and very merciful deity. So that's it. There's gates as one enters. And when the king would return, they would come to the gate and even outside the gate and receive the king. Something like what happened when same Satyayuga, when Dhruva Maharaj was returning from the forest, because he was gone for 6 months. Doesn't say how long Swayambhu Mata was gone, but when he was returning, the messengers of the king saw him returning, so the king sent a royal reception outside the gate with a special elephant, with this elephant seat just for Dhruva to sit in. And he and his queens and his other son Anupama were in the other elephant carrier conveyance and bringing him back and for a royal reception returning. So like that, the royal family, the royal entourage that had accompanied Swayambhuva Manu, now they were greeted back in the palace with opulence and decorations and musicians and a royal reception. Next, the city of Varhishvati, rich in all kinds of wealth, was so called because Lord Vishnu's hair dropped there from his body when he manifested himself as Lord Varaha. As Lord Varaha shook his body, this very hair fell and turned into blades of evergreen kushu grass and kasha, by means of which the sages worshipped Lord Vishnu after defeating the demons who had interfered with the performance of their sacrifices. So again, this is very early, not too super early, but very early in Satya Yuga. Saying that so early because already Devahuti's old enough to be married, and also already what happened is Hiranyaksha has been killed. So Hiranyaksha was born and he's been killed by Lord Varaha, and as Lord Varaha was emerging from the water with earth on his tusks, he shook his body to get the water off his body, and some hairs fell in this Varhishmati, and by the falling of the Lord's hair, it made it sanctified, and so the king, or the emperor, Swayambhuva Manu, made that his residence. And Prabhupada speaks about what makes something a place of pilgrimage, and where the Lord advents himself or has some pastime, or alternatively even where there's glorification by a congregation of pure devotees, by them coming together and glorifying the Supreme Lord, it sanctifies the place and makes that also a place of pilgrimage. Or, as stated in the Bhagavatam, where one who is a pure devotee of the Lord, because they carry the Lord within their heart, they make that place a place of pilgrimage. But in this case, this is where a pastime of the Lord transpired, and so it became a sacred place. Text 31. Manu spread a seat of kushas and kashas and worship the Lord, the personality Godhead. By whose grace he had obtained the rule of the terrestrial globe. I'll read part of Prabhupada's purport here. Manu is the father of mankind, and therefore from Manu comes the word man, or in Sanskrit, manusha. Those who are in a better position in the world, having sufficient wealth, should especially take lessons from Manu, who acknowledged his kingdom and opulence to be gifts from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus always engaged in devotional service. This is getting into the territory of those who live a life in the world, how to stay transcendental while you're living your life in the world, dealing with complexities and dealing with property and dealing with wealth and dealing with, you know, worldly things. How to exercise or support and maintain Krishna consciousness in that situation. So he's just settled his daughter in marriage. He's come back to his royal palace. He's been received in grand style. And the first thing that's mentioned, what he does, is he's fixing his mind in contemplation upon the personality of Godhead in a sanctified setting. Although he's the king, he's using these sanctified kusha and kasha grasses to sit on for purification or for maintaining purity and fixing his mind on the personality of Godhead. His attention is not going to his opulence and to the praise and everything that he's receiving from those who he's ruling. Rather, he's recognizing this is a service given by the personality of Godhead. My attention goes to him. When such acknowledgement is given, either by a family, nation, or society, their abodes become almost like Vaikuntha, and it becomes free from the operation of the threefold miseries of this material world. In the modern age, the mission of Krishna consciousness is for everyone to acknowledge the supremacy of Lord Krishna. Whatever one has in his possession must be considered a gift by the grace of the Lord. Therefore, everyone should engage in devotional service through Krishna consciousness. If one wants to be happy and peaceful in his position, either as a householder or a citizen or a member of human society, one must promote devotional service for the pleasure of the Lord. Now he's going to enter his palace. Having entered the city of Barhishmati, in which he had previously lived, Manu entered his palace, which was filled with an atmosphere that eradicated the threefold miseries of material existence. Not how we normally think of palace life. Here's what Prabhupada writes. The material world, or material existential life, is filled with threefold miseries. Body, mind, natural disturbances, and miseries inflicted by other living entities. Human society is meant to create a spiritual atmosphere by spreading the spirit of Krishna consciousness. The miseries of material existence cannot affect the status of Krishna consciousness. It is not that the miseries of the material world completely vanish when one takes to Krishna consciousness, but for one who is Krishna conscious, the miseries of material existence have no effect. We cannot stop the miseries of material existence. But Krishna consciousness is the antiseptic method to protect us from being affected by the miseries of material existence. For a Krishna conscious person, both living in hell and living in heaven are equal. However, Swayambhuva Manu created an atmosphere wherein he was not affected by material miseries, as explained in the following verses. So specifically, He arranged things in such a way that a spiritual atmosphere was created within his palace. And because it was the center of the kingdom, then also within the kingdom. He created a spiritual atmosphere within the kingdom. That was his duty as the emperor, to set an example and create a spiritual atmosphere for those who he was overseeing or in charge of. So the next verse, Emperor Swayambhuva Manu enjoyed life with his wife and subjects and fulfilled desires without being disturbed by unwanted principles, contrary to the process of religion. Celestial musicians and their wives sang in chorus about the pure reputation of the emperor, and early in the morning, every day, he used to listen to the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead with a loving heart. It sounds very similar to the life of Maharaj Ambarish. Daily, specific with Maharaj Ambarish, he had the Krishna deity, and early in the morning he would every day for many hours be involved in worship in his temple with his deity of Krishna. Here it's similar. He's despite not being distracted by the royal opulence, he's focusing his attention on the personality of Godhead through specifically being mentioned here as hearing regularly about the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead with a loving heart. So there's embedded within the messages what Swayambhuva Manu does, but it's also instructive for us. Being involved in the world, how to be protected from the onslaught of unwanted things that come from being in the material world. There's by spiritual strength and spiritual protection and spiritual purity that come through the direct devotional processes. So I'll read the purport, or part of it. Human society is actually meant for realization of perfection in Krishna consciousness. There is no restriction against living with a wife and children, but life should be so conducted that one may not go against the principles of religion, economic development, regulated sense enjoyment, and ultimately liberation from material existence. The Vedic principles are designed in such a way that the conditioned souls who have come to this material existence may be guided in fulfilling their material desires and at the same time be liberated and go back to home, back to Godhead. It is understood that Emperor Swayambhuva Manu enjoyed his household life by following these principles. It is stated here that early in the morning there were musicians who used to sing with musical instruments about the glories of the Lord, and the emperor with his family personally used to hear about the pastimes of the Supreme Person. This custom is still prevalent in India, in some of the royal families and temples. Professional musicians sing with shanais, and the sleeping members of the house gradually get up from their beds in a pleasing atmosphere. During bedtime also, the singers sing songs in relationship with the pastimes of the Lord with shanai accompaniment, and the householders gradually fall asleep, remembering the glories of the Lord. In every house, in addition to the singing program, there is an arrangement for Bhagavatam lectures in the evening. Family members sit down, hold the Hare Krishna Kirtan, hear narrations from Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, and enjoy music before going to bed. The atmosphere created by this Sankirtan movement lives in their hearts. And while sleeping, they also dream of the singing and glorification of the Lord in such a way, perfection of Krishna consciousness can be attained. This practice is very old. As learned from this verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, millions of years ago, Swayambhuva Manu used to avail himself of this opportunity to live householder life in the peace and prosperity of a Krishna conscious atmosphere. Very practical, instructive message. As far as temples are concerned, in each and every royal palace or rich man's house, inevitably there is a nice temple, and the members of the household rise early in the morning and go to the temple to see the Mangala Aarti ceremony. The Mangala Aarti ceremony is the first worship of the morning. In the Aarti ceremony, a light is offered in circles before the deities, as are a conch shell and flowers and a fan. The Lord is supposed to rise early in the morning and take some light refreshment and give audience to the devotees. The devotees then go back to the house or sing the glories of the Lord in the temple. The early morning ceremony still takes place in Indian temples and palaces. Temples are meant for the assembly of the general public. Temples within palaces are especially for the royal families. But in many of these palace temples, the public is also allowed to visit. The temple of the king of Jaipur is situated within the palace, but the public is allowed to assemble. If one goes there, he will see that the temple is always crowded with at least 500 devotees. After the Mangala Aarti ceremony, they sit down together and sing the glories of the Lord with musical instruments and thus enjoy life. Temple worship by the royal family is also mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, where it is stated that those who fail to achieve success in the Bhakti Yoga principles within one life are given a chance to take birth in the next life in a family of rich men or a royal family or family of learned brahmanas or devotees. If one gets the opportunity to take birth in these families, he can achieve the facilities of a Krishna conscious atmosphere without difficulty. A child born in that atmosphere is sure to develop Krishna consciousness, the perfection which he failed to attain in his last life is again offered in this life, and he can make himself perfect without fail. It's a very practical thing. The method of staying protected or staying within the influence of the internal potency and mindfulness of Krishna, even in a life of worldly affairs and complexity. It requires commitment. But if one fulfills that obligation or commitment or lifestyle, then one can remain peaceful. Now, the king, Swayambhuva Manu, one can only imagine, he had, after completing these duties, he had many, 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 many other duties to fulfill, as do we. But the protection, morning and evening, of sanctifying one's consciousness in a suitable atmosphere, made passing through that stage of his life protected and gradually cultivating further and further Krishna consciousness, at least for us. So the last verse, thus Swayambhuva Manu was the saintly king. Although absorbed in material happiness, he was not dragged. This is a verse, not a purport. He was not dragged to the lowest grade of life, for he always enjoyed his material happiness in a Krishna conscious atmosphere. There's a verse in the first Canto, Chapter 2, that nice section where it gives principles of living one's life in devotion to Krishna. And the verse I'm thinking of in particular fits this description very, very well. Dharmasya hi apavargasya narto tayopakalpate nartasya dharmaikantasya kamo labhaya hi smritaha. Very, very important verse where the Bhagavatam is instructing that dharma or religious duty should never be taken up with the purpose of attaining sense gratification, but rather the purpose should always be ultimate liberation. And then the second part is, if from the performance of religious duties in that way some facility for sense gratification comes, it should never be accepted. So the motivation shouldn't be, let me become an enjoyer by doing nice pious activity, religious activity. And the second is, if it comes of its own accord, one should never deploy that facility for sense gratification, but should be deployed in service to Krishna. So this is an example of that principle being applied by a qualified person. And we learn how to lead our lives through the example of qualified persons, teachings as well as example. And that's how Prabhupada is creating the purports. It's instructive for us in our practical daily lives. So happiness is from spiritual well-being. Material well-being follows like a shadow. We discussed that in our class this morning. So if the focus, as with Swayambhuva Manu, is upon spiritual well-being, as the object moves, the shadow of the object will also move. So material well-being will come. And he was enjoying a very comfortable life, as an opulent, regal, comfortable life, as Swayambhuva Manu. But he wasn't indulging in that. It was a provision that he was acknowledged a gift by the Supreme Lord. But his attention was going to the Supreme Lord. So his life was free from the miseries and with, in his case at least, opulent life and material happiness. Still his attention was going to the Supreme Lord, not like being the enjoyer of the opulence. Again, the verse says, although absorbed in material happiness, he was not dragged to the lowest grade of life, for he always enjoyed his material happiness in a Krishna-conscious atmosphere. And a short purport, the kingly happiness of material enjoyment generally drags one to the lowest grade of life, namely degradation to animal life, because of unrestricted sense enjoyment. But Swayambhuva Manu was considered as good as a saintly sage because the atmosphere created in his kingdom and his home was completely Krishna conscious. The case is similar with the conditioned souls in general. They have come into this material life for sense gratification. But if they're able to create a Krishna-conscious atmosphere, as depicted here, or as prescribed in revealed scriptures, by temple worship and household deity worship, then in spite of their material enjoyment, they can make advancement in pure Krishna-consciousness without a doubt. At the present moment, modern civilization is too much attracted to the material way of life or sense gratification. Therefore, the Krishna consciousness movement can give the people in general the best opportunity to utilize their human life in the midst of material enjoyment. Krishna consciousness does not stop them in their prosperity for material enjoyment, but simply regulates their habits in the life of sense enjoyment. In spite of their enjoying the material advantages, they can be liberated in this very life by practicing Krishna consciousness by the simple method of chanting the holy names of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, appropriate for each person, there's some place to live, some residence, some facilities in that residence, and it may be of a higher standard or a lower standard. That's from lifetime to lifetime it changes, and even in one lifetime it may change from one situation to another situation. But the principles, regardless of this situation or that situation, the principles are universal. And the example setting, Swayam Bhuva Manu, is showing how to live in the world, creating a spiritual atmosphere by the activities that one takes up, and the way that one's consciousness is directed during those activities. And by that method, Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam, one's senses can be utilized for the service of the master of the senses, and thus be pleased. The senses, when satisfied, aren't looking or hankering for something else and something else and something else. Material sense gratification always leaves that situation. At what point are the senses satisfied in material life? There's always desire for something more or something else, or a combination of some other some things, or a better grade of something, something like that. It's endless. Devoid of the spirit of connecting with the Supreme, it's an endless position of dissatisfaction and wanting something else and something else and something else. That the pains of material existence are guaranteed just by the nature of the absence of God consciousness. And with the presence of God consciousness, just like with the contrasting position here of Kardama Muni and Swayam Bhuva Manu. Kardama Muni had nothing, at least apparently. He was living a life of an ascetic in the forest. Specifically, we read this morning that when Swayam Bhuva Manu came to see him, he was dressed in rags. And here's the emperor coming to a man dressed in rags saying, "Would you accept my princess as your wife?" Meaning, she's going to live in rags too. Because he doesn't have anything, but you know, that's his lifestyle. But on the other hand, the description is what he saw was like a gem that had not yet been polished, just taken from the mine. And so the shining of the gem was there, even wasn't yet polished. Within the lifestyle of Kardama Muni was an effulgent personality. So, Kardama Muni was not living a life of deprivation. He was living a life of ecstasy, of great contentment and great happiness. And what when one reads further in the section, incredibly powerful yogi, mystic yogi, that he wasn't attracted to those powers or exhibiting those powers or doing things to get those powers. His attention was just one thing, the personality of Godhead. And one who lives their life that way, whether they have little or they have a lot, as in the case of Swayam Bhuva Manu, he had a lot. And he was not disturbed and agitated by the lot and wishing that I had more, or trying to find this way, that way to bring happiness. During one of our lunch breaks at a GBC meeting recently, when I was in India before the Vrindavan Parikrama, there was a GBC meeting, and one of our GBC members is from the UK. His name is Pragosh Prabhu. And I was having another conversation with somebody about something else, but he was at the same table, and so I only heard half of it, but he was describing the history of Henry VIII. And what a terribly degraded person. And it's one of the reasons why people wanted to get rid of monarchy, because kings became so indulgent in the opulence of their position and the whimsical way in which they led their lives and were cruel to people and fallen, disgusting and disgraceful. But he explained this is something that's taught in, you know, standard literature for, you know, like their history classes. The history of England. You learn about Henry VIII, what a fallen creep the guy was. So respect for such persons is totally absent. But how did it come to that stage? By absence of God consciousness. And conversely, by presence of God consciousness, one can be in, you know, this end or that end, the Kardamoni end or the Swayambhuva Manu end or any place in between, and create a spiritual atmosphere by applying the principles that are suitable for this lifestyle or that lifestyle or anything in between. It's the principle of what's suitable for one and how to apply the principles in an appropriate fashion. And the Bhagavatam is for everyone. One of the glories of the Srimad Bhagavatam is that it's for it's a Paramahamsa literature. It's for the persons who are at the topmost stage of spiritual realization, and it's for the people who are the most degraded and unfortunate victims of Kali Yuga situation, whose lives are completely sinful and in a very compromised and embarrassing position. Because the nature and everything in between, because the nature of Srimad Bhagavatam is its glorification of the supreme, pure personality of Godhead, and it's presented in such a beautiful manner that it's very attractive. So just by coming in contact with that message, one becomes sanctified. By contacting that which is supremely pure, one becomes purified. So the unfortunate or the most elevated, it's that kind of a literature that's very, very pure, supremely pure, and elevates those who hear its message to that position, pure position. And that's what Swayambhuva Manu did. To protect him from being the enjoyer of his opulence, or that gift which the Supreme Lord had given him. Just continuing to recognize, this is a gift that the Supreme Lord has given me. Let me accept it in that way, utilize it in his service, and continue to cultivate spiritual consciousness from that position. That's the instruction that's being given in this section. Very, very practical, useful guidelines. How to live in the world. Necessities met. Happiness in a measured way found. And continuing to progress in spiritual consciousness. Very practical. So any discussion or questions? Yes.
I've been thinking that we have so much rich literature in Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. But sometimes I see that devotees want to take self-help from outside of a devotional community, even to lead a life in devotion. So, like, it just seems very contradictory. That you already have so much, but you're going somewhere else to get something. So how can I bring those two together?
Lead an exemplary life and engage others in the process of hearing and discussing together. I don't know so much what you're referring to as going elsewhere for things, but...
like self-help, you know, even to manage emotions, to, you know.
This sounds a little bit like part of the discussion that came up this morning. Self-help is different than managing emotions. Self-help, at least what I understand what self-help means, there's abundant, the very popular literature today, many books that are big sellers, are like self-improvement kind of literatures. And they're not... atheistic necessarily, but they're not theistic necessarily either. It's like, you know, go and help yourself to become a better individual, become a good leader, or become a better something. And then the thing with managing emotions is another issue. Not exactly, at least I don't think of it in those terms as a self-help type of literature. Our principle, here's just to repeat some of the points that came up this morning. Our principal means of deliverance is our Yuga Dharma, starting with the process of hearing and chanting and the other forms of direct devotional service, that's our means of deliverance. And that's for a life of a devotee of Krishna. That's primary. That's where our attention should go and should be maximized. So a little bit like developing good qualities. How does a devotee develop good qualities? I'm getting to your question. I'm not directly just now addressing your question yet. For developing good qualities, the formula is put one thing in the front and the good qualities will follow. So there's 26 qualities of a devotee, primary 26 qualities, of which one is Swarup Lakshana, the primary characteristic, and the other 25 are Tatastha Lakshana, marginal, or they follow the primary. So that the one is Krishna Ekasharana, or taking full shelter of Krishna. So one who takes full shelter of Krishna, the other 25 qualities, Krishna will decorate the devotee with those other qualities. And that's the faith of a devotee, otherwise they're not a devotee, they're looking for qualities. They're looking for self-help, and how do I improve myself in different ways. Mine is the primary one. Or maybe it's over there and that's like another one, is like be a religious person. I've had interactions with devotees who said they started coming to Krishna consciousness when they were in college because it was a religious thing to do, because they were like, you know, they wanted to be successful in their academic work, and it was a religious thing to do to, you know, to hear Bhagavad Gita, so they heard there was a Bhagavad Gita discussion, so they went to the Bhagavad Gita discussion because it would help them build their piety so they could be successful in school. It was a add-on. It was a corollary, not a principle. And this devotee said it took him about a year before the light went on. Although he was hearing, he didn't hear it till like a year later that, wait a minute, this isn't just an add-on. This is the primary thing. And then when that light went on, it was, whoa. And then I need to put my academics behind the primary. So not my, it's not important. But this is primary. Awakening my dormant Krishna consciousness, and when that light goes on, then I'll get spiritual strength and other capacity to do whatever I want to do for the pleasure of Krishna. That's the primary for the pleasure of Krishna purpose. Some persons don't get that. That even after more than a year, they don't get it. Some persons do get it, but they struggle. They struggle with all kinds of things, like emotions. And so it may be that something that's a support that can help sort out the emotions so that their attention can resume to the primary, then that's something that's helpful. In an example I was giving this morning was, I had a knee problem, and so I couldn't do lots of things. I couldn't walk up and down stairs properly. I couldn't pay obeisances. I couldn't do lots of things that I like to do. So I took physical therapy, and you heard me perhaps say this, when I went to the physical therapist, they said, okay, you know, they tested different things, and then they said, okay, what is it that you'd like to do? Like, what's your objective? What's your sankalpa from doing physical therapy? And I said, well, I'd like to be able to go up and down stairs and not be like an old man. I'd like to be able to just walk up the stairs, up and down. Okay, great, good. What else? I said, well, I don't know. Well, like, do you want to go play tennis? I said, no, I don't really desire to go play tennis. I said, well, you think about it, let me know. So I took the prompt and thought about it and said, well, over a year from now, I plan to go to India, to a holy place, and there is this, like, walking around a sacred mountain, Govardhan. I'd like to be able to walk around Govardhan Hill. I didn't say it, like, you know, use language that the physical therapist can understand. It's like, you know, it's 14 miles, 23 kilometers. I'd like to be able to walk it and not be a wreck afterwards. So he said, oh, I have friends going to India. You know, where in India you're going? It's like, all this conversation. But I took the prompt, let me do the physical therapy so that I can walk around Govardhan Hill. Because I really, 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 really like Govardhan Parikrama. It's like, I really like it spiritually. It's so uplifting. So that was my meditation. I was doing the physical therapy so I could get the spiritual benefit of Govardhan Parikrama. In the same way, someone that may take some help from something that helps them manage their emotions so that they can focus on hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam's message and chanting their rounds properly and worshiping deity properly and serve the devotees properly without obstruction, like physical therapy or whatever else. I took Panchakarma treatment for a month, and that was really helpful. It gave me, you know, the kind of health that enabled me to do my devotional service in a way that most people think I'm crazy, the level of activity that I maintain, but enabled me to do that. So I took that on board because of that purpose. Not that in and of itself it's my religion. So there's benefit that can be derived from those things, provided the primary stays primary. And the other things are to assist the primary, that's all. That's why they're there, to assist the primary. But if the primary is weak, or I lose focus on the primary, the other thing becomes primary. And that's very detrimental. Therefore, especially for practicing devotees, you know, beginners, we might describe things a little differently, but for practicing... For practicing devotees, with some reserve and you know, some at least mental cautionary, like let me not lose focus on the primary kind of caution, I can take help from other things because it may help me do my primary activity more effectively. No harm in that. At the same time, part of the discussion this morning is somebody may feel, I don't need to do those things. They're already built within the primary. I just do the primary, and that's sufficient. And that's a matter of faith. But it's also a matter of fact. But it takes a certain quality of faith, investment of faith in the primary activities of devotional service. And there are some devotees that they live their life that way, and they're very happy, and they're very balanced. So that doesn't mean if somebody has got a knee problem or some other problem, that they take help from those other things, they're straying from Krishna consciousness. It depends on the consciousness with which they take up those other things for the purpose of their primary focus, then it's supportive. You know, the Yukta Vairagya principle has it's like a blade with two edges. There's a blade that's an edge that's useful, and there's an edge that can be hurtful. We can utilize things in the name of Yukta Vairagya, utilize things in Krishna's service, where if we're not sufficiently strong and careful and cautious, we may get utilized with those things in Maya's service instead of utilize those things in Krishna's service. And it happens. One of the earliest lessons that I learned in Krishna consciousness is exactly that one. One has to be very, very cautious about using things in Krishna's service. If one isn't sufficiently strong and guided and cautious, one can just get drawn into the material energy. I watched it happen as a very new devotee, so I was, whoa, I want to be very careful. But then some things can be used in Krishna's service that are beneficial. Does that help? Something else? Yes?
You spoke about Kardama Manu and Manu, Swayamvara Manu, on this end and this end.
Yeah.
Kardama Manu is in the forest in a different type of lifestyle.
Yes.
Whereas here, Swayamvara Manu with the opulent lifestyle,
yes,
still he is able to use the gifts given in the service of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that the gifts given to personally for me here, it reduces my tolerance level.
Tolerance level. Tolerance in what?
Tolerance in, suppose say it's little bit colder, more, then I'm not able to, do something. Something is not working properly, then, everything has to be, put in place, that kind of mentality we get to set in and trying to get out of it. But that is what we are trying to get into a comfort zone in America, especially for me and for others. But the comfort zone, if something happens to the comfort zone, then everything else shakes. So whereas I go and visit devotees in India, and there are so many things going on, but they are continuing with their process and everything, and I cannot do that. I said, oh, this is too much. How are you able to do this without air conditioning and everything? And they say, like, you know, this is our lifestyle and we are used to that. But, you know, I see that even my children are growing that way. You know, no tolerance. Anything little bit there, they cannot tolerate. So I am trying to, you mentioned that I was thinking about that. These gifts are good, but that is also on the other side, if I am not thinking properly, they are giving me a comfort zone. Comforting factor, which if it is not there, then everything else is a problem. How to balance this?
Well, two things. The first part is not what you're asking, but those that are deprived are not necessarily Krishna conscious. One can learn to live without whining and complaining about inconveniences, but not be Krishna conscious, become stoic or hard exteriored, without necessarily being Krishna conscious, just become accustomed to disturbance. I mean, just to take it to an extreme, I was once visiting a temple, they had opened a restaurant. So they wanted to show me the restaurant, and they, part of the restaurant was a little reading room. And in the reading room was one of these big books, like picture books of India. So I was just leafing through the picture book of India, and it showed different tyagis. One was in the heat of the summer, he had built a ring of fire, and he was lying down in the ring of fire. Then another was Gangotri, and his yogi with his beard floating in the water, and all around is ice in the winter. Then another was a yogi lying on a cactus with thorns like this. So some persons may be able to endure physical pain and hardship, but not necessarily Krishna conscious. So there's that extreme. And then you take it to a less extreme, and it's, people who are accustomed to extremes of heat without air conditioning, and it is frankly the general chaos of India. And just tolerate it because that's the way it is. And people that are used to things being done in an orderly manner can't handle it. It's just like, it's crazy. Govinda was sharing with me, he kept using this phrase, organized chaos. In one example, he was pointing to some people. There's five people talking to each other simultaneously, and they can understand each other. And everyone's just like this loud to talking. My comment was the volume. They're not talking. They're yelling at each other. And it's five people yelling at each other. And then he said, but they can understand each other. Five people, stand next to those people and you can't, what are they talking about? It's not just language, it's just five people talking at the same time. And it's just standard, etc. Without, elaborating about anecdotal things. So some persons may just become accustomed to chaos and tolerate it. And there's some persons that may be, they want things to be orderly, and they can't handle it unless it's orderly, or whatever, the tolerance and intolerance borders. The real solution is Krishna consciousness, because one can be deprived, or one can have a lot, and in both cases, in either end, or somewhere in the middle, not be Krishna conscious. The real solution is not just to take your children and have them stay in India where it's chaos and it's too hot and there's no air conditioning, so they learn to tolerate it. That's not the solution. And for yourself, it's not the solution just to be without. the training that Prabhupada gave us was to be happy and peaceful with and without. That was the training. And to achieve that, it's exactly the message of Bhagavad Gita, seeing equally this extreme, that extreme of duality. There's only one. Siddha Pragya is only possible by fixed Krishna consciousness, not by just, you know, discipline. Go and sit in a cold place without a jacket. Or go and sit in a hot place and, you know, bundle up. It's not just sense deprivation. It's Krishna consciousness. So the solution for yourself, aside from what everybody else is doing and not doing, is emphasis upon Krishna consciousness. And that's exactly what's being said, because let's read it again. The world is filled with miseries, but one who is steeped in Krishna consciousness, those miseries don't affect them. So the have or the have not situation is not happiness or distress. Unless it, you know, the climate is, you know, move the temperature and the fan and this and that, now I'm comfortable, now I can chant. Unless it's that, I can't chant, I've always got to, I'm fidgety. It's Krishna consciousness. You know, you follow. It's first instruction that Krishna gives. Matra sparsha sukamteya sitoshna sukha dukha. So it's like ABC. And how do you go beyond that duality is by withdrawing consciousness from there and investing it in sat. It can't be done otherwise. You just like tolerate and tolerate. It doesn't mean you get transcendence. You just become strong in tolerance, but not transcendence. It's investing in transcendence and sat. It's making that choice. So when that moment comes where I'm feeling fidgety, or whatever the word that you used, I'm feeling uncomfortable, withdraw consciousness, recognize what it is, and place consciousness in Krishna. And have many times as you need to do that, keep investing consciousness in Krishna. And through that Krishna consciousness, it doesn't mean that the miseries are over, but they don't affect you. When there's a greater happiness within, the dualities aren't affecting you. The miseries of material existence are not. So it's the lack of Krishna consciousness. It's not, I need to be in that circumstance instead of this circumstance, or another change of circumstance. It's not going to create Krishna consciousness. That's my point. Making conscious choices that withdraw from asat and place it in sat makes Krishna consciousness. Very, very basic Bhagavad Gita understanding. So we emphasize chanting and hearing and the sat. And then someone can say, well, that's difficult for me because my mind is disturbed about asat configuration. This configuration is such that I can't pay attention over here. Then they're busy adjusting asat. It's just like trying to move the shadow instead of moving the object that's casting the shadow. It's a fool's errand. Yes.
I was thinking about this phrase, material happiness in Krishna conscious atmosphere. What I see is that my devotional capacity is very tiny. And so whatever facilities I might have, they may not all be employed in Krishna's service. At the same time, somewhat related to what Prabhu's point is, I need some of these facilities to basically continue on in my service.
Sure.
So it seems like it's almost self-serving that, you know, I need these many things at this point in time, without which even the tiny bit that I'm able to do for devotional service is not possible. So how should I proceed from this point?
Two things. One is self-honesty. And you know, part of that self-honesty is asking the question, do I really need this? And then the other part is gradually moving the fulcrum. Like, you know, gradually reducing, consciously reducing. Not, you know, impulsively and radically and in ways that are not sustainable. But in ways that are sustainable, is there something that I can do without? Let me do without it. And one way to do without it is you give it away. To somebody who thinks they need it. When you realize, at least I don't need it. But then the self-honesty is, there's a certain amount of whatever it is, paraphernalia or circumstance or whatever it is that without which, as you said nicely, I can't invest consciousness genuinely, sincerely, even the little bit that I have energy left and focus left to do. So self-honesty and consciously reduce privity and nivritti. So the nivritti process is gradually reduced, not artificially reduced. Gradually reduced. And the strength of gradual reduction comes from performance of activity and the devotional side. Like the discussion we had this morning. Emphasis upon the positive, or directly coming in contact with the Supreme Pure. To whatever degree you can do that, do that. Do it nicely. And with the faith that gradually the strength will come and purification will come that will permit me to gradually reduce. Because I'm feeling satisfaction. I just don't need all these things that I thought before I needed.
We discussed many topics here, and I find myself following certain things already. Then a feeling comes where I start feeling very special about myself. So how can I be on the natural platform and not feel very special about myself?
Pride. Yeah, that's what you're referring to? Something like that? Well, feeling special about oneself is pride. Pride means I have something and I'm special because I have this something.
I'm already following something. I'm already doing something.
Yeah. Okay. That's pride. So there's a few different methods that can be very helpful in reducing pride. You know, the extreme is, you know, Krishna comes and takes the thing away. That can happen. Krishna does that sometimes. He did it with Indra. You know, he does it sometimes with people, just like... But the higher principle is acknowledge, just as we were hearing, this is something that's come... Where that's something that you're already doing. Where did that ability come from? It came from Krishna. So it's using the very language here. It's a gift from Krishna. You didn't create it. Proof. It can be taken like that. Like that. Before you even think about it, it's gone. It's not created by you. It's a gift given by Krishna. So do you sometimes feed your child? not sometimes. And does the child recognize mommy is feeding me? He's just eating. Just taking it for granted. Mostly. I mean, conventionally it's like that. But you're undergoing something to see that your child has some food to eat and some clothes to wear, and, you know, when it's hot they have a jacket and they got shoes on and things. You know, you're doing what mothers do, lovingly. And Krishna is doing what Krishna does, lovingly. From our side, if there was a sense of acknowledgement of what Krishna is doing for us, a light goes on, like a gratitude light. And then there's a feeling rather than pride. It's, how wonderful is Krishna? How loving is Krishna? You know, let me count the ways. And then the feelings of gratitude will protect you from pride, from the sense of it's mine, and I'm this person is doing this good thing, I've got this nice thing going for me, because it's a simplicity of heart, a softness of heart, that this is a gift from Krishna, and I'm very grateful. Let me see how I can use this gift that Krishna gave in service to Krishna. But you lose sight of the gift, just like the child doesn't get something in the way that they want it or the moment that they want it, and they're throwing a little temper tantrum. You know, I see it all the time as I move around and watch kids interacting with their parents. And very demanding. It's never enough, and it's got to be the right way, and da-da-da-da-da. So, let us not be like that kind of a child. Let us be the one who is appreciating what sacrifice my parents are making for me. What how much is Krishna giving to me? That's an antidote for pride. See where it's coming from and the purpose for which it's been given to you, and then utilize it with that purpose with a grateful heart. And even a bigger picture, that's a personal picture, but the bigger picture is everything that exists comes from the same source. Whatever you have and whatever he has and she has and they have, it's from the same source. Krishna is the source of everything. And then, you know, I'm not so big after all. I'm this little speck that's part of everything. So he who is the source of everything is the one that should be, let my attention go to him. Yeah.
Naturally we will come to.
Yes. And as Swami Bhuvamana was doing, if we also do, we can hear the glories of the personality of Godhead, then our attention is going to him, not upon ourselves. So material conscious, false ego, our dear friend, false ego, is we think ourselves at the center. And everything, our perspective is everything is revolving around us. That's false ego. And Krishna consciousness is, Krishna is the center of everything, and everything is revolving around him, including ourselves. And everybody else around us is simply for Krishna's pleasure. We lose that by being covered by false ego, which then pumps us up to think in prideful ways, in other kinds of, you know, not very charming characteristics. So the antidote is hearing regularly about Krishna, his glories. And then our feeling for Krishna and our recognition of he's at the center, not us. A false ego is dissipated, and Krishna consciousness replaces that false ego. We're tiny little fragmental parts of Krishna being engaged in his service by his kindness. And here's some resource by which I can serve Krishna. He's very kind. Like that. It just dissolves the this pride thing. And there is that other option. We can just carry on with pride and Krishna can smash us, take a big hammer and bang us in the head. And that thing which we were proud of is gone. We got a big bump in our head. It hurts. Then we go, oh, I think I was proud. Krishna wanted to teach me a lesson. Like that. Yes?
Maharaj, I had a question on expectations.
Expectations.
How do we see... sometimes I feel that, you know, I'm attached to some of the expectations. You know, it could be my kids, my wife, you know, other persons. How do we come out of that? Or is there a way that we can kind of make that... not to be attached to those expectations? Is there a way to? Because you have some set of expectations, and you know, does it fulfill? And then you kind of, you know,
expectations is two things. We're at the center, and that's one part. That's necessary element of expectation. And then another is fruitive. Like, I want something. I've got my eye on that something, and it's supposed to happen because I want it. So
sometimes
that's the mode of passion. It's fruitive. There's a goal, and I'm chasing after that goal, and the goal is supposed to happen because I want it to happen. And I'll, you know, do this and do that and the other thing, and a combination of things to get that, because it's fruitive. So that's the mode of passion. So change the channel to the mode of goodness channel. So that means elevate your lifestyle in other ways, including the expectation way, where, you know, it's Krishna consciousness. I'll do my prescribed duty and whatever Krishna wants. I'll give a little example. I wanted to have a very nice yatra. Try it sometime. Plan a yatra in Vrindavan. You have to make a plan, and it never works. Well, it seldom works according to the plan. And there's always this... So, the outcome is completely in Krishna's hand. But that's part of the ecstasy of having a, you know, pilgrimage in Vrindavan. And you're in Krishna's hand. And he can do with you whatever he likes. And it happens, like, you know, 50 times a day. Everything completely changes. But you still have to have a plan. Like, where are we going to take prasadam, and who's going to cook it, and how they're going to get there. And so you can expect, recalibrate your expectation that I'm in Krishna's hand, I wish to serve Krishna for his pleasure, and my expectation is I'm going to make a Krishna conscious try to please Krishna. And the outcome is completely in his hand.
Sometimes I see that there's a clash between expectations.
Of course. That's called material life. So, you know, one solution is just live by yourself. Then you don't have other person's expectations clashing with your expectations. But we're social beings. We want company, so we have to accommodate. But, you know, better is to elevate. What does Krishna want? Let us together find out what Krishna wants and work cooperatively to achieve what Krishna wants. Then it's no longer a mode of passion, it's a mode of devotion. We still have some idea. I have and they have, you know, whoever are the other people involved. their expectations. But, you know, we try to direct those expectations to what does Krishna want. And, you know, that's the art of living a Krishna conscious life. And it's difficult when we're, you know, the mode of passion is prevalent. We have our wants. And we think that there are even needs. I need this outcome. And otherwise I can't be peaceful. That's the illusory energy. That voice, that's the illusory energy. As long as we're in that condition, we'll be, you know, be disturbed perpetually. And be disturbing to others because we have our expectation or projecting our expectations upon others, even if we don't say it, we're projecting it. Like, you're not going to please me unless X, because that's my expectation. Then it's clash. It's conflict. Yes.
Maharaj, I wanted to ask, like, how can we fix our consciousness on the sankalpa that we make for ourselves? Because I was thinking that whenever we have love as a driving force, then it is more easier to fix our sankalpa and, like, stay on it. But then
sounds like you're answering your own question. How can you fix, and you feel you can do some more when you're in love? There's love is behind it, and
yeah.
So then you work on that. You've answered your question. And practice acting from that platform as opposed to the other platform, and associate with those who can act from that platform to help you develop that capacity. So we keep association of devotees. And we have especially very strong relationships with those who we can learn such qualities from. Okay? Yes?
Thank you very much. I was trying to think about the last part of the purport, where it is nicely described about how the families were coming together and performing Krishna consciousness activities and bhajans and kirtans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also thinking about, you know, it was easier at that point in time to be Krishna conscious.
Try being a Manu for a while. It's like you find it easier.
I was just trying to relate it to, you know, Kali Yuga, and, you know, even now, people get together, they you know, dance together, but on mundane, you know, songs, and they get together for eating, you know, Thanksgiving,
okay.
Turkey.
Don't elaborate, I guess.
Yeah. So I was thinking it would have been easier if there was one religion, and, you know, it would have been easier for associating.
Sure, it'd be easier if there's one mode of nature, mode of goodness only. But that's not the way it is. And the diversities of religions is because there's modes of nature. That's why. There's diversity of religion because of the modes of nature. So don't dream. It would be nice if there's only one mode of nature.
I was just thinking in terms of associating with others, who are not Krishna conscious.
Just be an example. I'll use myself as an example. On the way back from India, it took me between 2.5 and 3 days because a flight was canceled. And it took them 7 hours to decide to cancel the flight. And you can imagine, you know, the restlessness of the people, waiting for that. And then we had to stand in line for 3 hours to get an assignment of where we were going to spend the night. And then the other, what the next, you know, the next rebooking was. So people were restless and hungry and grumpy and, you know. So I'm standing in the middle of all those people wearing my dhoti. You know, I'm to be an example. Although, so they have, the modes of nature were very active. Different modes. Prompted by the circumstance. A few people started a conversation, like a kind of curiosity conversation about, you know, are you with a monastery? You know, here in America, they would say, are you a Buddhist monk? But this was Europe, so they were saying, are you part of a monastery? They just, you know, out of curiosity, they just passing the time. So, but by being in that circumstance and being sense controlled, you know, it's just chanting. It was real easy. We're very fortunate. We can spend so many hours just chanting, and we're contented. I wasn't restless. My feet were getting tired just standing in line for a long time, but so you don't have to have one religion to practice Krishna consciousness in a place where there's people where the modes of nature are active and their belief systems and what grounds them is whatever grounds them. There were some pleasant older ladies that were just, they were just happy. There was some, you know, there's a whole range of modes of nature playing. Just to be transcendental. And you know, with everything, you like eating and speaking and behavior and, you know, be friendly and, you know, just, you know, be, attract them to Krishna as part of your service rather than, you know, convince them that their religious ideas should be more like ours or something like that. Be Krishna conscious is the solution. And where there's an opportunity, then invite people to hear a transcendental message according to their capacity to hear. Yes. Two questions, but speak a little louder.
How do we distinguish between what we want and what we need?
What we want and what we need. And? Okay. This is a little bit more like his question than his question. His question was about expectations. And his question was about, you know, what I think I need in order to be, you know, peacefully carry out a modest amount of Krishna conscious activity. That was his question. I don't know any scriptural answer to your question, but you know, a practical answer to your question is that which is sustainable is the criterion for what you need, without which something isn't, your the balance of your life is not sustainable. That's something that you need. He's a special boy. A want is, I don't really need it, but it's, you know, there's a contemplation, like the message of Bhagavad Gita, by contemplating an object, one develops some attraction for that object and the desire to have the object and make a plan to get the object and like that. You can't develop attachment. When it's not really a need.
Okay.
and that there's a lot of stuff that's involved in our lives that's not need. It's we think we need it, but it's just we don't need it. It's just a want. So the criterion that I'm suggesting is that which is sustainable without is in the category of want, and not sustainable without is in the category of need. And connected to that is, as your Krishna consciousness increases, your needs diminish. They fall more in the category of want, and then you just even lose the want. It's not really a need. As Krishna consciousness increases. But to sustain your Krishna consciousness, there may be a certain amount of things that one needs in order to sustain Krishna consciousness so that your needs can follow, can diminish. And what does Krishna want? You know, that the standard is Guru Sadhu Shastra. And the ultimate of those three is Shastra. On what basis? What does Krishna want? And then we get access to how to properly understand scripture through Sadhu and Guru. Anything that Sadhu or Guru may say is grounded in Shastra. So that's the, you know, Supreme Court is Shastra. And then through the medium of like our great acharyas and the 12 Mahajans, for example, or something that Bhaktivinoda Thakur said about Narottam Das Thakur, that whatever he wrote is as good as scripture. So that gives you some indication of what Krishna wants. Prabhupada made it really simple for us by saying, in real simple language, by pleasing the spiritual master, you're pleasing Krishna. So, you know, what does Krishna want? That's too far away. But what does the spiritual master want? That gives me an indication what Krishna wants. If the spiritual master is pleased, then Krishna is pleased. If that's what Krishna wants. So, then there's a place you can go and ask, you know, you can ask, what does Krishna want? But another way is, in this circumstance or that circumstance, what would be best? What would be most pleasing to Krishna? And if we just even ask that question, a lot of gray areas removed and a lot of light comes in just by asking the question. What will be pleasing to Krishna? Because the gray area comes in when we lose track of what does Krishna want, we think, what do we want? We know we're at the center instead of Krishna's at the center. Anything else? Time for prasadam. Okay, Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Srila Prabhupada Swami Maharaj ki jai.